This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington, where earlier today, the president is starting to raise questions about whether the November election should be delayed. Only Congress has the power to make such a decision. And this week, it's been hearing from those in charge of firms so powerful that they could influence what happens in our elections. Four of the world's most powerful tech CEOs virtually sat before the House Judiciary Committee's antitrust subcommittee. That was on Wednesday afternoon. They were there to reassure the American people that their companies can be trusted. The committee chairs referred to the CEOs of Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple as the emperors of the online economy. And with great power comes great responsibility. Let's talk some of this, talks about more of this with Zephyr Teachout. She's an associate professor of law at Fordham University and author of the new book, Break 'em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. Professor Teachout, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with some of your key takeaways from the hearing. What came up about how powerful these companies are?
Well, one of the most striking things about this hearing was how different it was than previous hearings we've seen. You may remember when Zuckerberg was hauled before the Senate after the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And the Senate actually was kind of embarrassing. They didn't seem to know what questions to ask. They were kind of begging Zuckerberg to support their pet bills. This was a totally different hearing, and this antitrust subcommittee has run a totally different kind of investigation. They came with documents. They asked very specific questions about particular anti-competitive acquisitions, particular anti-competitive behavior. And this subcommittee was extremely well prepared. And the tech CEOs started out with the lofty statements, but they ended up really being on their heels for most of the hearing. I thought it was a really exciting hearing.
Well, so did a particular theme emerge around this issue of power?
Yeah, I mean, one big theme that showed up with all of these four is that they all use their market dominance and their power to crush competition. As David Cicilline, the chair, laid out in the opening, and various Congress members laid out in their lines of questioning, they have these different strategies to protect their monopoly power. One is to acquire them. And there we saw new documents and reference to new evidence that has come through that when Mark Zuckerberg bought Instagram, he was doing so to protect against competition, which you're not allowed to do. And there were some pretty grueling lines of question about internal documents in that area. So one is acquiring companies that might compete with you. Another is basically killing them by making sure they don't show up on your platform. And there was some strong questioning of Tim Cook about why various apps that competed with his apps vanished from the App Store just as they were pushing their own apps. And we also saw some really powerful questioning of Jeff Bezos about whether or not they are using their incredible position where they can really spy on all the sellers who use their platform to get data and then use that data to launch their own products. And Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal was just had several different really exciting moments in the hearing.
Well, let's listen to one of those exchanges.
And one was when she was asking...
This is an exchange with Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg and Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal from Washington State.
Did you ever use this very similar Facebook camera product to threaten Instagram's founder, Kevin Systrom?
Congresswoman, I'm not sure what you would mean by threaten. I think it was public that we were building a camera app at the time. That was a well-documented thing.
Let me tell you that, in a chat, you told Mr. Systrom that Facebook was, quote, developing our own photo strategy, so how we engage now will also determine how much we're partners versus competitors down the line. Instagram's founder seemed to think that was a threat. He confided in an investor at the time that he feared you would go into, quote, destroy mode if he didn't sell Instagram to you. Facebook is a case study, in my opinion, in monopoly power because your company harvests and monetizes our data, and then your company uses that data to spy on competitors and to copy, acquire, and kill rivals.
Professor T. Chow, unpack some of what was happening in that exchange.
It's great. It shows that the committee has really done their work because they're talking about email and chat exchanges they uncovered in their investigation. They give the lie to Zuckerberg's claim that they were purchasing Instagram just to improve their product instead of following this copy, kill, acquire strategy. Basically, if you don't sell to us, we are going to run you out of town. And there's a kind of mobster element to the way all of these different CEOs, when you look at the internal documents that we're learning, operate. Jayapal had a similar line of questioning with Bezos, where she's saying, do you use the data you have on sellers to launch your own competitors? And he couldn't answer the question. He said, it's our policy not to, but I can't promise it's not happening. And during the hearing, he had to admit that Amazon competes with the sellers that it says it serves. So these are, you know, these companies, if there was any question, we're seeing that these companies have not only achieved choke point power, but they're using that choke point power to create what Representative Joe Neguse called a innovation kill zone. Basically, if you come too close to us, we're going to acquire you, copy you, or kill you.
Well, this hearing, as you said, was the culmination of a year-long investigation into big tech by the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Antitrust, Commercial, and Administrative Law. That investigation led to 1.3 million documents of information. We haven't seen those documents, but how much of a sense did you get about what's in there?
Well, we just saw the tip of the iceberg, and I think we're all very eager to see what the documents are and also see what the committee's report is. It looks like we're going to learn a lot about possible predatory pricing when a company radically lowers its price in order to push out competitors. There are a few lines of questioning to Amazon about that. But one of the things that was so different about this hearing is Cicilline was really clear that they mean business. And I think the report will be really interesting both for the documents, but also for what they propose. He was talking about breakups. He's saying we really need to move beyond this moment where we allow these companies to control so much of our lives and then abuse that control.
Does having this hearing in the middle of a pandemic when so many people are struggling to make ends meet hurt the case of these companies?
I think it really does. I think what you see is, you know, when you saw the recent report that Jeff Bezos made $13 billion while people are struggling, as people used to say in this country pretty regularly, monopoly is a form of theft. And we kind of lost that understanding for a long time. But that $13 billion in his personal wealth is coming at the same time that people are suffering. It's coming from small businesses, from workers who are not getting treated fairly. And in fact, these tech companies are some of the only ones doing really well in the stock market. So I think it's clearer than ever to people that the reason they are doing so well isn't because they're particularly smart and isn't because they're providing us particularly amazing services. It's because they figured out ways to use their monopoly power to extract money from the people who depend on their platform. And it's leading to increased inequality. And, you know, we don't want these robber barons in this moment of incredible suffering.
That's Zephyr T. Chow, an associate professor of law at Fordham University and author of Break 'Em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. Professor T. Chow, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, we'll speak to writer Zadie Smith about the turbulence of this year and how she's making sense of all of it through her art, or at least trying to. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp, a truly affordable online counseling service. Fill out a questionnaire online and get matched with a licensed counselor best suited to your mental health needs. Whether it's depression, anxiety, or trauma, BetterHelp will help you overcome what stands in the way of your happiness. Learn more at BetterHelp.com and get 10% off your first month with promo code 1A. BetterHelp. Get help anytime, anywhere.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Until recently, Edmund Hong says he didn't speak out against racism because he was scared.
My parents told me not to speak up because they were scared. But I'm tired of this.
Listen now on the Code Switch podcast from NPR.
I'm Jen White in Washington. The last several months have been dizzying. For many of us, we're just now stepping back to reflect on all the ways our world has changed since February. Or in the case of George Floyd's killing and the ongoing protests against systemic racism, the ways our world hasn't changed. In her new essay collection, Intimations, writer Zadie Smith meditates on the whirlwind that has been 2020. Everything from the value of art during these times of social upheaval to privilege and racism as viruses in their own right. And she joins me now from her home in London. Zadie, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you begin by warning the reader that while, quote, there will be many books written about the year 2020, historical, analytical, political, as well as comprehensive accounts, this is not any of those. What is this book?
That's a good question. I think sometimes when I'm with my students, I notice they feel a pressure to write the ultimate book, the book that does everything, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. The book that is all art, all politics, all activism. And I just wanted to be honest about what writing is to me, which is often a much smaller area. And for me, this book was literally self-help, I think. It was a way of controlling the days, when the days felt completely outside of my control.
Well, in the first essay, Peonies, you find yourself admiring tulips through the bars of the Jefferson Market Garden in New York. This is pre-pandemic. It's a beautiful and it's an image that really captures you. Why did you want to open the book with that image?
I was interested in the things that are uncontrollable in life. And I suppose, particularly in New York, we usually are under a mass delusion that everything is under our control, ourselves, our friends, our communities, our work. Of course, COVID unpicked all of that. But I think there are always hints of it in your daily life. And to me, this kind of instinctive, natural response to these flowers was something that I didn't approve of in myself. And those gaps between who you want to be and who you actually are what I was interested in exploring.
Well, T tweeted us and says, you said a decade ago that writers should be ready for the lifelong sadness that comes from never being satisfied. Do you still advise that?
Well, that might also be my pathology. I mean, I really felt when I was writing this book, the inaction of writing. I was surrounded by people, fortunate to be surrounded by people who were active, who were politically active, marching on the streets. And I thought a lot about the kind of passivity of writing and my guilt around that. And there's always a disappointment there that writing isn't something else. Mm. But given that it is what it is, I'm always trying to find the most useful purpose for it. Like, can I make things that are tools for others? That's the best way I can put it. Can I write an essay which allows somebody with a completely different temperament, with a completely different ability to do the things they need to do? Because that's how, when I read, that's how I experience writing, that someone's giving me a gift that enables me in some way in my life.
You said the passivity of writing, and that really stood out to me. In part because I'm reflecting on an essay Representative John Lewis had published today on the day of his funeral. That
yes,
is,
I read it.
Oh, cool. And I read something like that, and it is, for me, all action, and there's nothing passive about it at all. Can you unpack that for us a bit?
I feel that too. I mean, I was reading recently No Name in the Streets, Baldwin, and I was thinking of all the action and energy in that prose. But at the same time, it's very different from the speech that's given at the barricades or the politician's argument. There is always in the writer a further question. Yes, but. Yes, but. And that part, for those who prefer action and action to happen immediately, is always an irritation, right? It's always not what was required. They don't want to hear often second thoughts, ambivalences, doubts. But to me, that's part of what writing provides. It speaks, hopefully, to the active person, to the activist, to the hero, but also to that human person behind all of those roles. I'm always trying to think about the person behind the phone, the person behind the laptop, the person behind the barricade. I know that that person also has bits of themselves that need attending to, that maybe journalism doesn't attend to, maybe political speeches don't attend to. There's something else there. We used to call it spirit. And for me, a writer like Baldwin, you know, when he's taken out of context, you can put any of those lines on a banner. But if you read him in his entirety, he's talking to the spirit of a person, which is a far more complex matter and the kind of thing that doesn't make good speech.
Hmm. Well, in the essay Screen Grabs, it's not one essay, but it's a collection of vignettes. We get these really tender portraits of an elderly woman, a young IT guy, a nail technician, and other people right as the pandemic hits. What drew you to these characters?
I was thinking a lot about the various conversations and debates and energy around social justice. And I thought, above and beyond actions and rhetorical strategies and arguments, surely the end subject of all these social justice arguments are human beings. And that if you don't have a clear and rounded and compassionate view of human beings, all your arguments for social justice will be hampered. You know, they're not abstract arguments. They're not for the people. The people involve many people, individual people of many races, many classes, many creeds. Those people are my business, as far as I have a business, which is not very far being a novelist. But remembering that those people are not just symbols, statistics, arguments, rap sheets, whatever, that they are people, that's my work. And even more practically, I just missed people. You know, I was, like everybody else, stuck with my very nice but small family. And I miss strangers, and I miss walking down the street, and I missed the excitement of somebody's face, which is really what starts me writing, just seeing people, wondering about them. And so I ended up writing about people I really didn't know very well, but who had had an effect on me. That, to me, is the most extraordinary thing about living in a city, is not knowing your neighbor, but knowing that they mean something to you, and hopefully that you mean something to them.
Has the experience of the pandemic made you rethink in any ways the way you relate to those people who are, you know, part of your neighborhood, part of your community, but maybe who you don't interact with on a deep level?
Yes. I mean, I'm as guilty as anyone of treating other people like objects or instruments, things to get by. Walking down the street and seeing someone coming towards you and thinking, I don't have 15 minutes for this person. And that impatience has broader implications, you know. The thing which, I mean, I've tried to write about my entire career is about participating in the commons, in a communal space. And 10 years in America was extremely challenging to that belief and that philosophy, because the commons in America is very hard to find, if you don't mind me saying. Mm-hmm. And the kind of systems that I grew up in, state schools, state healthcare, state housing, the most benign version of those three things, create the kind of commons I'm talking about, along with parks, libraries, swimming pools, etc., all of which is incredibly hard to find in New York, other than being funded by billionaires and all the rest of it. So if anything, for me, it doubled my sense of the importance of the commons, and that what was partly revealed in the American response is that when there is no commons, there's nothing to work with. There's no way for people to help each other. And yeah, I mean, yeah.
At the same time as I was reading Screen Grabs in particular, it felt like a series of goodbyes. I know you're in London now, and you left New York City before things got bad there.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I feel that way. I mean, I've landed in my old borough, Brent, which in England is the worst hit COVID borough. So we have more deaths here than we have anywhere else in the country. So it's a series of goodbyes. You know, I've felt so sad leaving in America, but when I came to England, everybody here is also saying goodbye to a version of their country which is no longer, or it doesn't exist at the moment. But yes, to me, it did feel goodbye. It's yet to see if it will be permanent, but I have to say, I feel, you know, for all the inequities of England, and there are many, I do feel grateful to be in a space where the commons still exists, even if it's in skeletal form.
We're speaking with author Zadie Smith about her new essay collection, Intimations. And with you, I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and from our guest in a moment.
Everyone loves pistachios, and pistachios love water, and California doesn't have enough water. So how do farmers figure out who gets to grow which nuts? Economics, of course. On the next episode of Planet Money Summer School, we explain how we all get along. Classes every Wednesday on Planet Money from NPR.
Well, the year is far from over, but more things have happened in the past few months than most of us could have imagined. We're speaking to writer Zadie Smith about how she's tried to make sense of 2020 in her new book, Intimations. Zadie, there are moments of levity in the collection. I particularly enjoyed some of your musings about perimenopause and menopause as a woman of a certain age, but there are also heavy critiques of American culture. In the essay, The American Exception, you write, quote, death has come to America. It was always here, albeit obscured and denied, but now everybody can see it. What about America and its relationship to death were you trying to comment on in this essay?
I mean, for me, I didn't mean to state the obvious, but the healthcare situation in America is so confounding to Europeans and has been for so long. I don't think I'll ever understand how it became the politicized question it is. But in its foundations, there is the sense of privilege bought. Which is something, the way I grew up, it's hard to imagine healthcare being considered in that way. But that kind of idea that there are those who can buy themselves into health and life and time, that foundational idea runs through the society. How could it not? And poisons everything. And then when this kind of crisis comes, which happens to be specifically a health crisis, those inequities are, as everybody has said a million times over, highlighted in extremity, but they're there every day. I remember when I first came to America, sometimes my friends would laugh at me when I was trying to set up my life, and I'd ask, where is a doctor? And they'd ask me, what kind of doctor do you want? And I'd say, you know, the one closest to my house. And they all thought that was hilarious, because of course in their realm, doctors are a matter of consumer choice. And there are many to pick from, and you decide on the best and you pay for the best care. And the idea of locality being a part of the argument was so distant from them. It was one of my first clues that I was in a completely different kind of society.
Well, in the book, class and privilege are recurring themes. And there's a moment in one of the essays where you're forced to confront your own privilege. And it was a really fascinating story. Can you tell us that story?
Oh, it was, I mean, I'm sure there are a million examples, but I was in a subway buying a sandwich with my son when he was a baby. And I heard two women of color, one South Asian, one African American, talking about their outrage at seeing a small child, a baby with an iPad in the pram. And to me, my first response was that this was an argument about, you know, the attention economy or technology and children. And then as they kept on talking, I realized it was the much more sensible argument about why on earth would you give a child something worth $900? And it was just striking to me because it's the kind of argument which I would obviously have understood without question, say, 10 years ago. And now this bubble of class, of luck, of money means that the conversation is interpreted differently. It's a tiny and stupid example, but it's one of these things where you don't know what you don't know. And you have to remind yourself again that there is a completely different consciousness around this object, this item, this argument. This happens 1,000 times a day in everybody's lives, as far as I can tell, but it was just a comic example.
Well, in the essay, Suffering Like Mel Gibson, that's where you write about suffering as a bubble, very similar to privilege. Would you read a bit from that essay for us?
Yeah. Just before the global mess hit the fan, we were in a long, involved cultural conversation about privilege. We were teaching ourselves how to be more aware of the relative nature of various forms of privilege and their dependence on intersections of class, race, gender, and so on. As clarifying as this conversation often was, it strikes me that it cannot now be applied without modification to the category of suffering.
Were you thinking about suffering in this way prior to the pandemic?
I think I was slightly unnerved in my middle-aged way by the ease of dismissal of human beings that I was hearing in my classes and, of course, online. Even that sentence, which I know is always partly comic, but, you know, so-and-so is trash. Mm. These people are trash. Those people are trash. Some sad little humanist part of me was also always slightly horrified by that construction. And it seems possible to me to make the most radical arguments about reversals of privilege, about interrogations of hierarchy, about rehauling entire social structures without resorting to the complete debasement of human beings. Those two things don't go together in my mind. And I was also aware that the language is partly not our own. The nature of the algorithms that we're involved with day and night, and this really is not our fault, but it's something we should be responsible about and be aware of. The nature of the algorithm is it benefits from the extreme. So it's not enough that the person is annoying. It's not enough that the person is unfair. It's not even enough that the person is unjust. Trash. Trash is the ultimate term within the algorithm. And so it goes for every debate, that the only thing that can be expressed in that medium, the only thing that rises to the top, the only thing which makes itself distinct is extremity. And I really worried and wondered about all the people, all the feelings, all the human capacities we have that are lost in that algorithm, that can't appear because they are neither the lowest nor the highest. So when I'm writing, for me, it's a very small form of resistance, but the resistance perhaps is not the one that comes to other people's minds immediately. To me, it's a resistance of form. I refuse to speak in that language. I refuse to speak in extremity because the algorithm wants me to, or flippantly because the algorithm wants me to, or at speed because the algorithm wants me to. I want to speak at my own speed, with my own thoughts, collecting my own thoughts at my own pace. Not because it's my privilege to do so, but because I believe everybody has that right. That's a right we should retain, and that the algorithm is absolutely adamant in telling us we don't have, or that it's absurd to hope for, or nostalgic, or we're Luddites for even wishing to, you know, don't believe it.
Well, in the essay Postscript, Contempt as a Virus, you write, quote, "You start to think of contempt as a virus, infecting individuals first, but spreading rapidly through families, communities, peoples, powers, structures, nations, less flashy than hate, more deadly."
Yeah.
That the less flashy than hate, but more deadly. I mean, we talk about hate. We talk about hate speech. But contempt is not something we talk about very often.
Because contempt implicates everybody. Like, you can't use exactly the same language you used in 1930, in 1890, in 1725. To me, if you always come to activism with the same set of ideas, it's ahistorical. Things have changed. They have changed in many ways from 1850. Some things, of course, remain the same. But to me, the use of the word hate lets way too many people off the hook. Most of us, most reasonable citizens, I think, can say or say to themselves, I don't hate anybody. And I'm sure they believe it and they feel it to be true. But it's really not the question. The question is, are you involved in the commons? Do you believe in it? If our lives matter, if black people's lives matter, are your children in school with us? Are you living in the same neighborhoods with us? If we deserve the same ends, or the hope of the same ends, because no one can ensure that we all have the same ends, that's up to our own abilities, etc. But the possibility of them, if you believe in that, that is a belief in social justice. If you don't, if you have contempt for us, if you fear us, if you'd rather be in the next neighborhood, if you would love to put the black page on Instagram, but would rather your kids went to the different school, this is contempt. It's contempt for the idea that there is genuine equality between us. And I'm sure those people don't feel hate. And it's a relief to say, no, I don't hate anyone. I certainly don't hate anyone on the basis of their race. But the way American life is structured, and of course not just American life, but as it's the topic at hand, speaks implicitly of contempt at every stage. The separation itself is filled with contempt and fear. And that implicates a far larger part of the country than, you know, the Klan or the crazy white nationalists or whoever. Contempt spreads from coast to coast.
Zadie, so often in these conversations about racism, any of the isms, people talk about needing to change hearts and minds. And you focus a lot on structures. Why is it so hard, do you think, for us to shift? Or why do you think we believe that we have to change hearts first and that structures will follow?
I think changing hearts and minds is much cheaper from the view of the political class. It's much easier from the view of the individual. And it's much less frightening. I mean, the truth about real structural change, and I think again about the establishment of the health service in England post-war, that was a fight, right? The doctors, British doctors, did not want that to happen. Of course they didn't. It meant the end of their privilege, which was real. They were paid in a different way. They lived in a different way. They had a different role. They came into people's houses. They were, you know, borderline upper middle class in the complex societal structure of England. What they were being asked to do was to participate in the commons. And it was a sacrifice for a few years. It wasn't easy. And it was mostly the young doctors who had been politicized who came forward and forced that through. Once it was in place, I mean, I should say doctors in England do not starve. They do very well. But part of a restructuring is you have to make a decision. You do have to make a decision. Are there going to be these extraordinary gaps in wealth? Is a doctor going to make $3 million or is he going to make £150,000? What is reasonable? So these restructurings, you cannot deny someone will lose something. That's true. Something will be lost. And any version of discussion which pretends that's not the case is deceitful. But what will be gained is the question. And what's been gained in England, as you might have seen the people clapping just as they do in America, for in New York, for our National Health Service every day for months and months. The National Health Service here is a blessing, a church, a creed. It's something that every person in this country believes in. And it's life-saving. It took a sacrifice.
That's Zadie Smith. She's the author of several books, including her latest essay collection, Intimations. Royalties from the book will go to two charities, the Equal Justice Initiative and the COVID-19 Emergency Relief Fund for New York. Zadie, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
We are on Instagram. You can follow us at The 1A Show. This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame, and our podcast is produced by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.